Hi, I'm Andy Acton.
And I'm Chris Strevens.
This is Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast.
What an absolutely fascinating episode.
It was. I mean, we've both met Abby at various things, but it's always good to know, isn't it? And to find out their sort of motivation and a bit more behind the person you meet,
yeah.
Or the person that other people see and hear.
Yeah. The bit that struck me is... We recorded an episode a while ago now with Munis Iqbal, and Munis, a very humble guy, done really well for himself, but his episode got picked out by young people in India and found him inspiring.
Mm.
It has the sense that this is going to be the same, particularly in the south of India, where he's from, that kind of brotherhood mentality of seeing somebody that's done so phenomenally well. But I was also quite taken with him talking about timing. I'd never really heard anybody talking about timing in the way that he did and how important that is for his success.
Yeah, I love the collaborative, and I think it runs through a bit like, you know, that sort of stick a rock thing. You almost feel collaborative that he wants to be successful or is successful, wants to be even more successful, but actually not at the expense of others.
No.
He wants to bring people on his journey so everybody benefits, which is lovely. It was really good.
It's a generational thing. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Something you could do to really help us is you could subscribe, because that would be amazing. We do release episodes every Monday at 7 o'clock in the morning. So you can get a new one pop in your inbox and you'll get a notification. So here's into the episode.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Here we are, another episode of Dentology. How are you doing?
I'm very good. And this is very exciting. This is like in a different place.
It is.
This is like, wow, this is like almost a proper podcast.
If you're listening to this as a podcast, you wouldn't see, but we're in a studio today, which is very special.
Yeah. And I feel I'm going to sing.
It's going to be a good one. So today we are very fortunate. We have a guest. We have Abhi Krishna joining us, and Abhi is the CEO of CareStack, the disruptive dental practice management software, which has recently entered the UK. He's also a serial entrepreneur and investor. Mm. Welcome, Abhi. How are you doing?
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, great, Andy and Chris. Thanks for having me on your show.
No, not at all. We're looking forward to it.
Regrettably, can I just say, I was going to have a great joke to start with, the fact of those of you who are watching, you will see this is one of the first times Abhi doesn't have a beanie on. However, he has got a cap on.
No, it's so, all good. We go on YouTube.
That's true.
It sends
you can
people
see,
loads of YouTube.
I think the only time I've seen Abhi without a hat on was probably in Florida, and that's probably because it was hot. So, welcome.
Before we get started, your childhood in India must feel a world away from the high-tech commercial world that you're in now. But I always believe there's clues from our childhood that kind of tell us who we are today. So is there a time you can look back on your childhood and say, that's the reason I am the person I am today?
Sure. Andy, I was born in the state of Kerala, which is like the southernmost part of India.
Okay.
And the town I come from, it's called Trivandrum, which is the capital of the state. It's a very, very unique town because, you know, a vast portion of India is very right-wing and conservative from a ideology perspective, whereas my state has probably been the only state which has had very left-leaning political system governing the state for the last 3 decades.
Right.
Okay.
So it's a very anomalous state, which in many ways doesn't identify itself as part of India, if I were to give a very...
Like a sub-state almost.
Yeah. Like a realistic description of folks from my state. And the state is guided by the strongest feelings of brotherhood. Right. So even as kids growing up and studying, you know, though we were from this small little town, we studied all things that was happening in the world. We were fascinated as kids by stories of Che Guevara, right? Mao Zedong and, you know, Karl Marx and all those things that was happening globally. So the state is a very, very anomalous state. If you kind of match it to rest of India.
Right.
The state also has the highest levels of literacy in the country. So there's like abundance of human capital.
Mm.
Probably the most advanced public healthcare infrastructure.
Mm. Just out of interest, Abhi, is there a disproportionate amount of super successful people from that region?
Ask, is it like an incubator?
Yeah, because
like
it's a very, very small state.
Right.
Which does not have a lot of
sort of population, rough idea on population. give us a sort of an idea?
Yeah. Compared to the rest of India, it's quite small, but it, you know, you might find it a little bit out of your range, but it's 3 million people.
Right. Okay.
So 30 million people. Right.
But by
right.
Indian measurement, yeah. that's
Indian
quite small.
Yeah. But by billion or whatever it is, it's a small number.
Indian measure, it's just a small number.
Yeah.
So going back to what I was trying to state there, you know, the state is very anomalous because, you know, A, it has had all these left-leaning influences. But secondly, you know, because it's such a small state, it does not have a lot of real estate for physical infrastructure.
Mm.
Right. Yeah. So it put in a lot of focus on the human capital component of the state. For example, we consider our factories as schools. And human capital is kind of like the goods we produce from the state.
Right.
It's such a small state because the lack of the physical infrastructure is really compensated using, you know, our faculties on the education side, which can form great human capital.
Right.
And the state is very, very multicultural in terms of its thinking, diversity of thoughts, and nothing like the rest of India.
Right,
so okay. I come from that state.
Interesting background.
Having been, you know, having had all of my childhood to adulthood just in that atmosphere of.
Was that where you did your degree?
Yeah. I did my degree in the state. You know, it's a very contrarian state. And the communities are built and bonded by the deepest feelings of brotherhood.
Right.
So that's my being.
So extending from that, is your childhood and that upbringing and that location the thing that sets you on the path to success, or is it your environment?
No. You know,
is it one step before? Is it DNA?
I think it's a very interesting question, Andy. You know, I have been what I call as a late bloomer in life, because for a very long time in life, I have had pretty much no notions around success. What I mean by that is that wasn't my natural state of being, because I liked to do things at my own pace, things which had some intersection of design and creativity to the way I conduct life itself.
Mm.
And that phase of my life lasted till 33 years of my age. In my own ways, I thought I was happy, and being happy was what successful being.
You were happy being.
And for context, you're 42.
Correct.
Now. So you did well for nine years.
And
much of what has happened in my life, which kind of gives me some sort of acceptance from mainstream, has happened in the last 9 years.
Right.
But for a good 33 years of my life, it's been I felt happy in my own rights, but from, if you measure me by the standards of the world, I'm probably
but I think sometimes world measurements, I think one of the easiest measurements is numbers and money, which I don't necessarily think is the best measurement to use, but it's the one that
on where you are as well.
Yeah, I think it commonly gets used as a measurement.
So what's the catalyst?
Yeah.
So what was the change from 33 to woof?
Yeah, I think it's a very evolutionary thing, right? So, for example, I come from a family of traders, where my father, my grandfather, we have all run a family business in my hometown. So, in many respects, I think I had this whole thing of trading in my DNA, which I was in denial for a very long time in life, where I spent pursuing other things in life. And then, you know, my notions about finding an employment all came down to just, you know, it was just an economic activity for me to find employment enough to feed myself.
Mm-hmm.
And what I figured out doing that over a period of time is that I wouldn't fit really into a standard hierarchical system, which would put first people in a box and then force them to find things outside the box.
Right.
I just did not belong to those kinds of environments. I was craving for freedom and independence. So back in 2010, I started a design agency focusing on providing user experience design solutions to organizations in the world.
Mm.
And I was just happy running that agency with a handful of customers, you know, focused on very creative work where we could really come up with solutions that would improve the end user experience, primarily for software applications that were about to be rolled out by large enterprises.
That sounds almost like your first stepping stone from India to disrupting the practice management software system.
It's an amazing change, though, isn't it, to go from being employed? By the sounds of things, you were employed before, to then sort of almost waking up one morning and going, oh, I don't want to be employed anymore.
No, Chris, I was not employed for a long time. In my entire career, my employment lasted for close to 2 years.
Right.
I've had long breaks after that where I have not really gone into a full-time employment at all.
Right, okay.
And I've done freelancing. I am a self-taught designer who ended up starting a design agency after 2 years of freelancing. And then kind of found a way to, in many ways, fall in love with the process of design and design thinking in order to create solutions that would create a meaningful impact to the end user. And the pursuit of that process led me from one place to another, which eventually took me to this group practice owned by the largest dental insurance company in the United States. This is back in 2013, to build a product which sits on top of their dental software and allows the practice to manage their existing patients for chronic diseases, starting with a disease going by the name of obstructive sleep apnea. And that's kind of how I got introduced to a practice. And I was building this product, which could integrate into their existing dental software to manage sleep apnea, over the 2 years, I kind of figured out that, you know, the existing underlying dental systems were so inadequate that you couldn't really bolt on solutions on top of that. And that got me going on a first principles thinking mode as to how to really solve the problem, which led me to this answer that maybe there is a way to re-platform the underlying system and create a modern system in place which can serve the needs of the clinical community and the business of dentistry on a single solution. And that's how CareStack was born. As the idea had more subscribers in people, we had the first set of investors, and you know, we had, fortunately, we had good people joining the team in the early phases of the company, and you know, things started moving from one spot to another.
You make it sound very simple, Abby. And I guess a lot of that comes down to your ability to have first principle thinking, that you break things down into very simple steps. But I think for lots of people listening, so you have a user experience design company. You then go and work for a dental insurance company, identify an opportunity that practice management software is a bit clunky. It doesn't really work for the end user. And now suddenly you're talking about, you've now got this business, and we'll get to CareStack in a minute in terms of what it's turned into. But I'm sure people are kind of scratching their heads and saying, so how does a guy without a network in the southern tip of India come up with an idea to then suddenly find himself in the States working for an insurance company who then disrupts the practice management software, and you get interest to the extent where you get good people and money joining you?
The thing for me is you suddenly end up with that. You casually passed it on, but you then get investors, and it's like so many people listening even get to the stage where they even think about it.
Yeah, so investors. What are those kind of those building blocks and those stepping stones?
Andy, I think the intrigue happens to people who watch the whole thing from the outside. As somebody who lived this through, I was just obsessed with this process of creating it. Right.
I'd say you're still obsessed as well, Abby.
Yeah, no, but
he's not gone yet.
but I was hugely obsessed with this, and I'm a very impatient person by birth.
Oh, really?
So once you get obsessed, you want it out as soon as possible, right? And then you are just like a single track train running towards the objective, and you lose track of time. You just don't worry about a lot of things that would otherwise bother people with a lot of wisdom. Right?
Do you not need much sleep?
I don't, but my point, Chris, is you know, once I landed on this idea and this thesis that maybe it makes sense to really rebuild the underlying dental software program and build it in a way that you can connect it to other constituents and parts of the healthcare ecosystem broadly and make the practice very successful.
Did you see that solution from day one? Because obviously most startups...
No, it's over 2 years.
There
isn't much to this thinking, Andy. You know, because these systems all exist, right? Mm. If you walk into a dental software, in dental practice in US, you need a dental software program to manage the daily operations. Mm. Unfortunately, these programs are most 90% of the market works on desktop systems. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then they are bolted on with third-party systems to manage other crucial functions like patient engagement, analytics, reporting, membership plans, mm-hmm. payments, etc.
And I think people just get used to that, though, don't they?
They're probably legacy systems, yeah. aren't they, built when, you know,
it's mostly legacy systems at the core with some systems bolted on top of it. But these are very essential systems to build.
Yeah.
So CareStack, the idea of CareStack is nothing innovative. It's basically looking at what's existing out there and choosing to build something that brings it all together. So the necessity of that solution is not questionable. It's just something that people need to. You're really building a central operating system. What's questionable is, do you really want to do it? Because this is a very, very hard task. So the rationale behind choosing to build a business around it, going against the grain of change and the forces of incumbency, that's what becomes hard. And it has to be for rational people. You know, people stay out of that lane because they think through it and they understand that it's a lifetime worth of work and sustained efforts for a long period of time to get this to fruition,
but,
right?
But whilst it's hard, it's obviously been taken on board as a great idea, given the team you've got around you and the investment you've had.
Andy, there's no idea. The idea already exists because you're not inventing something new. You're just replicating what's out there in a better manner. The unknown here is whether you would be successful doing that. And wise people, if they basically go back and compare, you know, the risk, the odds of winning at it, would choose to make a rational decision, right? And I was naive, self-important, and highest degree of self-importance with great ignorance, and therefore I chose to do it. So much of starting and pursuing the idea had to do with my ignorance and self-importance. Therefore, that's the notion on which you start. There isn't much novelty to the idea.
But why would you say it's not an idea? It's kind of a blue ocean strategy. It's innovation and value. It's putting things together in a different way. But it's not invention. Most things are already out there. But the way you put it together had never been approached in that way
before. But that's execution. Once you start doing it, you get a bunch of people together, people will have their way of solving for it. And it's a choice to execute.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you sort of end up with you create a techie solution, being a non-techie person, for something that is already there. But as you're saying, you're just adapting it. But then you have to present it to someone to say, you need to change what you've got into this. So then that becomes a salesman's role, which quite often doesn't fit with a techie person, because a techie person is quite often a techie person. Mm. They're not really. So I'm assuming that's sort of how it rolled, was that you sort of like spent 2 years designing this and then saying, look, guys, you need to switch.
Look, I think 2013 to 2014, I spent time inside the practice, working from front to back, assisting the practice with daily operations. And because I come from a design background, I get a view of what's happening as workflows inside the office, and what's needed to basically streamline the workflows, you know, the existing solutions, how they work, and what can be made better. So you have like a fundamental view of what needs to be presented to these practices, right? So that helps you create the grain of what you want to create.
Yeah.
Now, should you be doing that? That's a question that you have to weigh in against the total addressable market that you're trying to chase. Can you ever earn your right to win in that market, considering the forces of competition and incumbency that exist around you? You know, is it worth giving that sort of time in your life, that at that specific point in your life, committing to this sort of a journey? Are you successful? Will you be ever successful in finding capital and resources in order to give the journey
fulfillment? The point at which you're having to decide those things, it's an unlaid road. For where you are now, you can say, well, yeah, of course it was a great idea, it's worked. Yeah. But when you're sitting there without the road laid in front of you, that's quite a big decision.
No, it was an easy decision. All you had to do was be naive, ignorant, and stupid. You know,
naive is great. We quite like naive.
Yeah, that's all there was to it, right? And I kind of think there's this famous quote by George Bernard Shaw, which goes something like this. It says a wise man adapts himself to the world. Whereas a unreasonable man adapts the world to himself, and therefore all progress in this world depends on the unreasonable man, right? Mm. So it's one of those things, you know, you're just unreasonable with things around you.
But you say about naivety, we've had many guests on where we've talked about the power of naivety. So when you're setting up a squat dental practice, if people genuinely knew all the trouble and the strife and the grief that was going to come their way, they probably wouldn't do it. But when you're in it, you've got no choice. Mm. You've just got to deal with the issues as they come. And that's kind of a lot of what you're saying is you start it, and then as each issue presents itself, you just find a solution and you just keep going.
I will add to that. That's part true. And then what I recognized is as you start getting smaller successes, you start becoming passionate about things. Mm. So for example, you know, so I decide to basically go at an idea of this sort and do it. And as I decide to do it, you know, I need validation for the idea. And you know, my biggest validation came when, you know, there was a doctor who was the dental director of Celebration, the practice where I worked for 2 years, who decided to put $1 million on the table on a PowerPoint slide to bring this idea to life.
Wow.
So you had a customer giving you an open check of $1 million on an unproven entrepreneur. I don't even know if I could be called an entrepreneur back then. I had some goodwill with 2 years of work ethic that I had demonstrated while working inside the practice. But besides that, there was no credentials to the resume. But I was thrown like $1 million to basically go ahead and build it, right? And on the weight of that $1 million, what I figured out was as I was talking to other people, similar people, and people who had built similar things in other industries, I saw that there was willingness to part with resources and money to expand on top of what the doctor had already laid on the table. That's like a sign of a success. And that sign of success fuels your passion. So I have come to this thesis that the more successful you get, the more passionate you become and more purposeful you become around it, as opposed to the other way around, right? Like I hear a lot of people...
Success breeds success.
Yeah.
Success also breeds passion. You know, I hear many times I've heard people talk about how being purposeful and passionate can lead to success. I almost think in my case it was the other way around.
Right.
You know, you
get more
you jump into something.
Yeah.
Without just being trigger happy.
Mm.
And in your journey, those 2 years or when you were starting, then you sort of launched, do you think, was there ever a time when you thought, flip, I'm not too sure I should really do this? Or is it, you know, like a true, as we sort of see an entrepreneur that says, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to go straight down that track. I'm there. I'm betting on black and I'm just going to go for it.
But Andy, that's how I'm wired. Yeah, I'm like a 0 or 1. Mm. In usually my life choices are all like I don't have I don't work like a 0.5.
Yeah.
And I'm like I get obsessed. Once I get obsessed, it's basically it is very difficult to detach myself out of it.
Deflect you.
You know, there's this famous Charles Bukowski quote which says, "Find something you love and let it kill you." Right. It's one of those things, whether it's be about building a company or falling in love with someone, that quote simply, you know, it's applicable in both instances.
But you've done it and you've done it well. Just to kind of bring this up today, it's interesting you say that your first practice or the support was from Celebration, which is in Florida.
Yeah.
And fairly recently, you kindly invited us over and we attended your Inner Circle event, which was over in Florida. In fact, literally 100 yards from Celebration at Gaylord Palms. And when we attended that, it struck me that your keynote speaker was Mark Gallagher, who's got a career in Formula One. And he talked about people and technology equaling high performance. And if we kind of break that down into those two components, the people bit, I'm fascinated to find out because as business leaders, we set the vision of in terms of where we're going, but it's our teams that will effectively live the culture and build the culture.
And deliver it.
Yeah, and it struck me in those few days in Florida that your team completely and utterly believed in what CareStack's doing. How have you built that sort of culture within the business? Because it's becoming quite a large business now. And when there's only a few of you in a room, it's easy because you can keep talking about the same thing and you can keep reinforcing it with those people. But how have you set the vision and created a culture with those people to that extent?
Where, and quickly.
Yeah, well. it's deeply believe quick. In what CareStack's doing. How have you done that?
I think, and it goes back to most things is top down, right? You know, what's happening at the top breeds down to the bottom. So I'm a strong believer in that adage. Mm. Now, that being said, you know, for us to really be successful, we need to know who we are and what we stand for, right? So one of the fundamental beliefs that has led us all this while is who is CareStack to our clients in US? Are we a software company? Are we a services company? Are we a solutions company? Who are we, right? It's very easy to be misled to think that we are a software company and we will build software. In my mind, we were never a software company. In my mind, we were a services company, which was simply willing to do more for our customers than what they would ever pay us for. Okay? What does that statement mean in reality, right? If you look at a dental office in US, just imagine like it's a single office, independent office with four chairs, 10 staff members, using 3 to 4 different software programs, which are either non-integrated with one another or loosely integrated, and staff members who are probably not having a great education of any sorts, and the doctor not a trained operator, primarily a clinician running an office, right?
You described a fairly typical UK dental practice as well.
I think most of the offices globally, this is like a common theme. For a practice of this sort, right, from an operator's perspective, from the practice owner's perspective, the fundamental thing that matters to them is, you know, the amount of dentistry that they do, the sort of relationships that they can maintain with their patients, and some sort of a peaceful atmosphere that they can have at the practice. Yeah. But with all those inefficiencies that exist and the administrative burden going down, a dentist basically ends up not having enough time for themselves and not enough time for growing the practice by focusing on the patients. This is like a usual scenario. Now, this is the vantage point from which we look at this situation. So if you go back to breaking down to who we are, you know, how do we do more for our customers than what they pay us? It gets us to this fundamental understanding that we are not a software company, but we are a software-led solutions company, which is going to do a set of things for our clients that reduces the administrative burden inside the offices, simplifies the work and the life of our clients, and gives them more time to focus on themselves, their team, and their patients. Now, that clarity is set. Right now, how do we operationalize it in terms of the service offerings, the product offerings that we provide, right? That vision statement that we are a business solutions company willing to do more for our customers than what we pay what they pay us for, then translates into our offering strategy. So we say, okay, we're going to build a modern cloud-based practice management software system. We are going to have integrated payments as part of it, integrated memberships, analytics, integrated phone systems. And then we are going to build a service division which does insurance reimbursement services, virtual assistant services, basically involve ourselves in daily operations of the practice in a technology-led manner, which allows us to provide services that ultimately reduces their administrative burden and function as part of their team. Right. And make all of this economically viable for ourselves while we make a profit and makes business value to the practice. Right. So this sort of clarity is kind of very key for, you to build good culture in your team. Now, okay, this is the end state that we want to basically provide for our customers, which means you keep the customer at the very center of your universe. Now, how do you build a team, right? I'm the staunch believer that you build good culture when there's an inspiring model of growth. Mm. You don't start with culture and move forward. You rather focus on success and you create a culture. And the culture is a byproduct of a continuous stream of successes that you can continuously create that fuels an environment of growth, right?
The success is passion.
Yeah. So I think yeah, it links it back down, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So now, with that being said, I got to convert this statement now into doing more for our customers than what we are willing to.
It's got to become something. Yeah.
And therefore, this culture, if you look at the core of how culture forms, it forms when you're able to bring together people, structure, and incentives. You know, when you put all these three things together, the intersection that you get, that's pretty much what you would call as culture in your time, right? So let's look at the component. So if I have to do more for our clients than what they pay us for, then I need to be able to hire people who will do more for us than what we pay them for, right? And you know, Andy, you know, we always play with the hands that we get dealt with. Yeah. You know, you don't always have the liberty of getting to a lot of those sorts of people. So your people are going to be a mixed bag. Some of them will do more than what we pay them for. Some of them will do less. Some of them will do just enough, right? And therefore, we created a structure and an incentive program to manage for those very, very unique situations. You know, so you look at your people component and you figure out, okay, you have a good understanding of where your people component lies, how much of structure is essential, how much of incentives are essential, that puts it all together, that the net result is the outcome that can support the statement, the vision statement for the company. And this is a very, very conscious product. You know, it's a byproduct of conscious thought in a few different angles. You know, your people, structure, and incentives, bringing these three angles together requires you to have a deep sense of time and timing. You need to understand the fact that you are in a long game, right? Most businesses, especially businesses like ours, gets built over a 10 to 15 year window, right? So you think about life in like chunks of 15 and 20 years of that's your mindset, right? The second bit is you need to have
But that in itself is quite unusual thinking, isn't it? Particularly in the modern world where...
But Andy, you got to understand, I started when I was 33. I waited so long to start.
That's why you're in a rush.
Yeah.
You got some catching up to do.
Making up for lost years.
No, but even more funnily, you know, waiting another 15 years is no big deal.
No, but, right? But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? For you, you know, to use your phrase, a late bloomer, to then get into a business that you're saying is going to take me 10 to 15 years, and I've got to think chunks. That's kind of not modern society these days. Is everybody wants everything instantly. People aren't prepared to invest.
People want to build, sell it five times, I'm done.
But that's also very specific to who people are. It varies from people to people. In my case, I got sense of that timing. The time that's required for really creating a business of this sort.
But this also goes back to the vision. The vision gets set by the person at the top that says, this is how I see this thing evolving, and then gets passed down.
I'm interested in your recruitment culture, because for the guys listening, it's quite an interesting one. When you recruit, do you look for good people who might come from dentistry, or dentistry which has good people, or does it not really matter? Because we sort of say to our guys when we talk to them, actually, you want to recruit good people because you can train them to do the other stuff. So do you sort of look at the same way and think, actually, I want to recruit good people? If they happen to have dentistry, that's great, but actually, I just want good.
Chris, this question also ties back to the previous questions, which I wanted to complete. So one is that you end up optimizing your journey for a long enough time, right? The second bit is the timing of where you are. While you can be very rigid on the vision, you always become flexible on the details, right? So timing-wise, you know, there are, timing is a very, very hard construct to master in business, right? Mostly it comes down to just timing. If you are a great student of timing and you have a knack of making decisions, get just gets the timing right, you will do phenomenally well in life. But timing is so hard that there's no playbook that really teaches you timing. At probably 5 million playbooks to get it wrong, right? Therefore, you know, timing wise, you figure out, okay, I have something to accomplish, right? I'm going to make a decision. And you sometimes end up making a decision ahead of its time, or sometimes you end up making a decision, you know, later than where it's supposed to make. So there's always going to be a gap considering when you act on something, right? That's kind of where you need to fill that gap using the right structure of people, structure, and incentives. Let's say you made a decision ahead of its time, okay? The sort of hiring, onboarding, retention, and governance of the people that you put into place, you need to account for the fact that, okay, you have made something early on time and therefore you can afford a certain choice of people, right? Let's say you make something later than the required time. Now you have to catch up, which means the choice of people that you hire and the structure and the operating freedom and the incentives that you put in place, you have to create enough fluidity for people to run fast enough to cover up for a gap. Therefore, you know, the whole concept of hiring and retention is to be thought out in the context of timing. And you know, I strongly believe that it's horses for the courses. While you don't have to commit yourself to hiring people who can be toxic influence on the organization, I think there isn't a single lens to hiring. You need a far more balanced lens of looking at your people component and your structure and your incentives in the context of timing and for the time that you want to exist and come down to a very zoned in decision.
Very, very interesting. I think people will take a lot from that in terms of that as an outlook. Just going back to the time.
So you know, Andy, just doing, yeah, so what, how do we hire at CareStack? What we have figured out that we have a view of the business, which is 15, 20 years of time, right? So we are going to be a business which becomes successful due to a function of time. And therefore, we have enough data now to understand how we need to hire, okay? So we try to optimize our hiring strategy with people, at least 20% of our workforce with people who are high performance, who have the foundation for high performance, and who come with a high degree of alignment to the mission, which gives consistency, persistence, and patience. So 20% of our workforce is that. The other 80% of the workforce we optimize for longevity and consistency over talent.
So as they are consistently providing.
Yeah.
Correct. And they're coachable and they're trainable and they don't go into a zone of misalignment. We bring that. And the dental industry knowledge, as time has progressed, we have so much of internal systems in place where we can now start accommodating talent from other parts of from other verticals and other industries, that's not a blocker for us anymore. We are very open to that process. But that's how we come down to a decision. We look at 20% to be, you know, high performance and high alignment, and the other 80%, we are okay with low performance and middle performance, but we try to bring on people who are aligned
to be consistent and deliverance. Don't
also you? Imagine it'd be exhausting. Imagine if the 20% was 100%. It'd be exhausting that everybody's just high performing.
You'd probably just drop the ball, wouldn't you? Because people just wouldn't deliver.
But it goes back to what you were saying before about you're a software business, but actually your business solutions, and it's as much to do with service as software. And if you don't have the 80% focused on service and delivery, then it could just be chaos.
Well, I imagine that. I'd sort of think to myself that with a software business, you sort of think about, I just think about us, you know, most of our software works.
Yeah.
And you only really need it when something doesn't work, but then you need the customer service that helps you understand how to make
that's
it
what
work
you want.
Better,
you,
don't
you,
you?
You want it to free you up to do the thing where you make your money.
As you were saying, to concentrate on the patients.
Yeah.
So as you can have a better conversation.
You just going back to the time in Florida, I noticed that you refer to your clients as partners. When we were out there, I heard the phrase quite regularly, our partners. It's a very collaborative approach and a collaborative term. How do your clients' partners help you develop CareStack as a solution?
Oh, yeah, Andy, we are a function of time. You know, CareStack wouldn't have survived without our early customers. Because 90% of the company, 95% of CareStack are folks without any dental background, including myself, right? We all come from a non-dental background with very varied interest. And we did not, we fundamentally think we are mostly dumb people for very good reasons, because you don't understand workflows, you don't understand offices. The empathy required to understand the nuances of a dental office workflow doesn't get set from day one, right? So but who we are two things. You know, intent-wise, we are very, very obsessed with our clients. We genuinely want our clients to succeed, right?
Yeah.
And then we are learning machines. You know, that's the strength of CareStack. We are learning machines. We can start from a blank slate and build the skills up and learn rapidly in order to basically serve the most value for our clients, right? So when you come with these, and this is the culture code of CareStack, right? Like, intense form of customer obsession and continuous learning, right?
I'm saying that must help. I'm assuming you have then a really good feedback loop from your clients who say, actually, it'd be really good if it could do this. So therefore, you guys then go and do that, which then delivers it, and then, oh, there's something else.
And we must
constantly move.
And this sort of a culture code doesn't survive on its own. It needs an integrated effort from your customer community. We've been very fortunate in all the markets where we launched to get early set of customers who come and look at CareStack as a joint mission. So for them, this company is also about realizing themselves. There's a certain aspect of CareStack where we want customers to feel that CareStack is theirs too.
It's interesting. I think it dovetails brilliantly with right at the beginning you were saying the state you come from is a very sort of feels a very collaborative
I think so.
State.
It's, brotherhood.
It almost, for, you know, a lot of people say about partners, but you're never really too sure if they really truly mean partners. But I think from what you're saying, and it's sort of embedded in you, really, which then embeds into CareStack, which is quite interesting.
I can give you examples, Andy. You know, there's like annual events in our customer sites where I go to change tables, put their stuff together. So, and it could be some of these are like single site practices, and you know it would make no financial sense to do all of that, right? But then it has become some sort of a tradition, because the energy that you get while interacting with these founders, ability to freely brainstorm over a drink, right? The perspectives that you can open yourselves to, and the feeling of belonging that you get is like it's your superpower over time
is there a risk as CareStack gets bigger and you move further away from that, because it's already a sizable business, but you have huge ambitions for it, so are you still going to be putting tables together when you've got 20,000 practices?
Andy, the only way to manage that is to basically make sure that the company is product led for life. You know, I don't see CareStack having a sales-led leadership in the company ever. You know, at the core of this company exists our undying commitment and obsession to the customer and a deep-seated form of product-led thinking in order to solve these problems and deliver valuable solutions to the market. The conscious effort that we will have to put into place is to keep the company extremely product-led and to steer away from a sales-led culture that cripples innovation over time. So the choices of people that we bring in, into the leadership, we look for people who are who have a more balanced view of the business that is at the intersection of product, sales, distribution, operations, and customer success. Most of our leaders, if not all of them, have a certain degree of proficiency on the product. And over time, if they don't get there, they will get replaced.
I think if that can be retained, it would it would make it an exceptional business.
Because you do you sell loads of stuff, don't
you? Yeah, but you see it over time, thinking back to, you know, Florida again, but, you know, Walt Disney. When Walt Disney started, you know, the Disney Empire, that was about creating a family experience. You pay once to get into the park. He didn't like the funfair mentality of you had to pay every time. He liked this concept of you pay once, you go in, and you get access to everything. However, as time rolls on, that was back in the 60s. Roll forward 60 years, and now there's lots of incremental sales things happening in that organization to drive revenue, to drive shareholder value. So I think if it can be retained as a product-led business, I think that would make it distinctly different from some of the greatest companies that we've got out there. Because they tend to shift.
That's how we view the business. We are very product-led, you know, extremely client-obsessed. Extremely product-led. So you take all the client obsession to identify high-value problems. That goes back to putting time back into their hands by reducing their administrative burdens. And you solve those problems with a high degree of product mindset. Your solutions are extremely product-led.
Yeah.
And as that continues to happen, you see the brand equity getting built as we are delivering on our mission statement of doing more for our customers than what they pay us for. And that almost has a compounding effect with time. And even at scale, I think these cultural values have to be propagated down. And, you know, as long as you're these things are always top down, as long as you stay true to who you are and you're making a very conscious effort towards making sure that your organization is subscribing to these values on a near consistent basis, I think you can preserve that sort of intense culture.
I'm intrigued by one element. You talk so clearly about your strategy for the business and your vision for where it's going. Yeah, I've heard you describe yourself a number of times before as imperfectly perfect. And you use the analogy of Kintsugi, which you can probably explain to people what that is. So what is Kintsugi and what is imperfectly perfect for you? Because for somebody who has such clarity of thought about their business, it's interesting that you also describe yourself as being imperfectly perfect.
Yeah. And it can, you know, I'll start with Kintsugi. You know, Kintsugi is a repairing technique that originated back in Japan in the 15th century. It was started by this Japanese emperor. His name is Ashikaga Yoshimasa. And what happened is his favorite tea bowl, it broke. And he wanted it repaired. And he sent it to China. And the Chinese craftsmen basically put it together. And what they tried to do it is they reconstructed the broken bowl using metal staples, which looked very ugly to the emperor. So he wanted it. He gave it back to the Japanese craftsmen to redo it and make it look aesthetically pleasing. And the Japanese craftsmen took the broken bowl and put it back together using a form of Japanese lacquer called as the urushi. And they put the pieces together. And then they took powdered gold dust and applied it on the cracks. So this object that got mended, it came back to life and it looked much more beautiful than the object which prior to it was broken, right? So that process, kin means gold and suji means joinery. So kintsugi stands for golden joinery. It's that process of, you know, mending things which are broken and bringing it back to life. And in that process, it's a very time-intensive, specialized process which also celebrates the history of the you know, of the object. It flaunts its flaws and makes the person fall more in love with that whole process, right? Or with the object. It enhances the value, the emotional attachment on the object. Now that's Kintsugi, and the repairing technique owes its genesis back to a Japanese philosophy of wabi sabi. Which originated again in the 15th century. You know, wabi means fresh and simple. And sabi means beauty that stems from age. And wabi-sabi stands for the simplistic beauty of all things, which is aged and worn out. So, and the wabi-sabi principles are all built around Zen Buddhist teachings, primarily around, which states that nothing in life is perfect, nothing in life is complete, and nothing in life is permanent. Mm-hmm. And therein lies life's beauty, mm-hmm. right? And those are the principles on which wabi-sabi is built. And if you take a deeper look at it, you will see there is so much importance to these simple teachings, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, to begin with, your worries are not permanent. You know, you should all know that there's this adage that this too shall pass, which is a very elegant way to express the transience of life, mm-hmm. right? No trouble, no challenge withstands the test of time. You know, with time, everything vanishes and, you know, life comes back to some sort of stability and normal, right? So that's there. Nothing is perfect. You know, life is, the imperfection is the very natural state of life, right? There's in the thing called as the perfect thing. Mm. In the modern world, we have so much of obsession around perfection and symmetry and
Instagram, all that.
And
sort of
you find,
and it's stressful.
And it's false.
Yeah, you know, it's false and stressful. Trying to kind of create this perfect world.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, and
you're saying is embracing it actually de-stresses the situation.
Mm. Imperfection, just fundamentally understanding that to be imperfectly perfect, or you know, just to be imperfect is the natural state of life.
Yeah,
allows you to basically appreciate the present moments, right? Mm. And again, it goes back to like nothing in life is complete either.
Yeah.
So all, you know, work of art or all work of nature, you will see that it's a very incomplete process, only to lead to something else, right? So that sort of thinking allows you to fundamentally practice acceptance to most things that happens to you. And once you get to the fact that you can accept things that is happening to you, you start obsessing less on the finish lines, and you start focusing more on the next steps, and that gives you an endless list of possibilities to play with.
And have you always felt like that, Abby, or is that something that's developed over time?
No, I have been a victim to perfection, and you know, I've learned some of these things through hard lessons.
Right.
You know, so I still struggle with it as I work with the teams and try to, you know, dream up instances of perfection and then coming to realize that how stupid I am as I go on to that pursuit. So it's like you have to constantly remind myself about the fallacy of perfection. But while I say these things, I also want to tell you something that was quoted by this favorite author of mine called Charles Bukowski. He said that, you know, you should discard perfection as the ache of the greedy, but do not fall into the trap of the mass modesty of easy imperfection. Mm-hmm. So while it's okay to not chase perfection, you might not want to become prey to easy imperfection either.
Yeah. Don't accept mediocre.
And therefore, you know, between perfection and imperfection lies this fine middle line called as excellence.
Yeah.
So you need to push towards excellence, and that's kind of what's going to contribute towards success.
Why we've got you on our dentology therapy couch? You're impatient. You're an impatient guy. So why is that? Because you feel that it took you 33 years to get going. But where does that impatience come from? Because it's relentless.
I think, Andy, it is also a function of many, many different things, right? My impatience comes from a little bit of rage and anger as well.
That's interesting.
You know, I took a I have not found my fit in my social circumstances for a very long time. I've always been a misfit in, you know, growing up in a town, adopting adopting things in life which was anything but mainstream, right? And growing up in an anomalous manner compared to the traditional values that my family upheld, you know, choosing to drop in and out of jobs for a long, long time.
Did that cause tension?
Oh, yeah, all the time. You know, I was a constant source of worry to my parents.
Oh, really?
You know, into my early 30s, people thought that I would possibly die on the streets or something like that for the sort of choices that I did in life. So there's this residual rage that results from not having your spot figured out in a system that you're supposed to exist, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, CareStack has been my only worthwhile thing in life, right? And you know, it has allowed me to basically appreciate life and keep myself whole. And I think if CareStack was not there, I would have transitioned into a total nuisance to the society, right?
So it's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like that thing. What's that they say? You find your tribe. It's almost like you couldn't find your tribe, so you created your own one.
Yeah.
So you know that's quite an interesting one, isn't it?
And therefore, you know, all these, and then it grew beyond my, you know, it grew beyond me. It grew into a company. We employed 900 people today. Mm. It serves as a pathway for a lot of young people from my part of the world to maximize the potential.
Do you look back on it, you know, like when you've got all this, you've got 900 people, you're doing really well in the US, then you're going to come here, dominate, well, we think we can dominate the UK, and you've got Australia and Singapore. Do you sometimes sit there and go, oh my God, pinch me, I've got all this going on?
No, I don't. I think it was, there's a lot of work which has gone into the whole thing. I also think, you know, we were at the right place at the right time.
Back to time it again.
But I also think we have put in a lifetime worth of work into this whole thing, right? So let me just touch base on this position of impatience, right? So I think as CareStack grew into this platform beyond me, right, what I recognized is the same sort of realization and fulfillment that I had, you know, starting from a zone of, you know, no significance to some sort of a semi-honorable position in my society. I think everybody at CareStack has a shot at that sort of, you know, fulfillment. Mm-hmm. So I get impatient about the fact that human potential is not getting maximized. There's so much of residual potential inside CareStack, which can have like a self-perpetuating effect if we can unlock it, right? So a lot of my impatience comes from the inability to unlock that potential into a machine which can take the company and what we represent to greater heights. That's one part of it, right? The other part of the whole process is that, you know, as we continue to build on these smaller successes and we create like a business against it, right, you need to think of CareStack as a generational business which can transcend the test of time and be there for the next 100 years, right? Which means it has to be fueled by growth at its very core. This machine has to basically grow and get down to the zone of being able to have a very, very non-linear way of growing, right? And dental is one place where, you know, you're the pace of change that this market basically has isn't as high as, you know, what you would find in some of these other verticals. So I always get impatient about the fact that why isn't CareStack growing at a certain pace of change that you could possibly realize in some of these other verticals and other industries. So it's basically these two aspects which breeds that impatience, right? Now, when can we
get... It sounds like quite a healthy impatience. It's an energy and a passion to get
to...
It's to get there quicker. It's to do more.
For me, I don't know how others feel about it.
they might not agree with it.
I think so. And I think You know, from my perspective, I think it's impatience is good.
If you had to strip back all your experience so far to one key learning from your entrepreneurial journey, what would you say is the one thing that you take from your journey so far?
Yeah, it basically comes down to your ability to understand timing. This journey simply comes down to how well you have mastered the art of timing.
Mm.
If you get your timing right, you have nailed it. I have never yet met an entrepreneur who has got his timing right, but his skills and his charisma and his competencies were not so great, who has gone broke.
Mm.
But the reverse has always, I've seen smart people with all the resources who have simply screwed up on the timing, you know, going into the dumps. I've seen it many, many times. So this journey is all about the wisdom, the introspection, the retrospection, and the constant pursuit of learning that you need to apply in order to master the art of timing.
Okay.
Very interesting.
And understanding.
Yes. Yes.
And it simply comes down to as simple as when do you do what?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm.
That's what timing comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that simple thing of when do I do something in my business and in some aspects, how do I do it? This understanding is kind of very easy to be able to articulate, but extremely difficult to basically put into action in a real world sense, right?
Fascinating. And on the point of timing, we're done. But we can't let you go just yet. We have two questions for you before you can leave. So the first question is, if you could be a fly on a wall in a situation, where would you be and who would be there?
If I could be a fly on a wall in a situation, I would want to be in that room where I get to see Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger make decisions as they make investment decisions. Right?
They've mastered timing, haven't they? Those boys.
Oh, they have. And they're like so much ingrained into first principle thinking.
Mm.
And if you really look at it, right, they've said some of the profound things.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a world where progress is a very, very relative thing, right? It's like you don't have to be the smartest guy in the room. You have to do just enough things to be less stupid than most of the guys in the room.
I spent my whole life doing that.
Right? So just this is a very, very astute principle when it comes to investing.
Mm.
You know, exactly. Training yourself and disciplining yourself to do less stupid things and try to do that for a very, very long time. That whole discipline has such a compounding effect on how your business is shaped, right? So I would have loved to be a fly on the wall listening to how they make some of these decisions.
Interesting.
Just by learning from other people's mistake and building that discipline of sticking to doing less stupid things, and you know, it would give you a whole lot of learning, you know.
Yeah,
fantastic,
interesting.
And you're given the opportunity to meet somebody, so you can sit down with somebody with a cup of coffee or
living
a
or dead
glass of whiskey. Yep,
fictional or not.
Who would you like to take the opportunity to sit down with?
Charles Bukowski.
Oh, really?
Yeah, hell yeah.
You're fascinated by him, aren't you?
Yeah, he's one of the most.
We haven't had that one before.
No.
Interesting.
I'm not sure we'll have it again.
No, I think it'll be unlocked.
Yeah, interesting people. You know, there's a funny Charles Bukowski story, Andy. You know, I've mentioned this in a couple of places. You know, this guy worked at a post office for a lot of time in his life, almost 26 years or so. And he used to take his publications to the publishers and get them to publish his writings, and nobody would even give him a hearing. Nothing to blame them, because the guy was perpetually drunk. You know, he spent all his money on women. And he simply said and did miserable things. So people wouldn't really entertain him at all. And finally, I think after 20 plus years or so, one of the publishers decided to give his writing a shot and decided to give him a break by paying him a very small fee. And the guy published his first book called as The Post Office. And that publication became like a raging hit that he was catapulted to the highest levels of success overnight. And what happened after he got successful, he obviously made more money. He had more offers coming his way. And you would feel that, you know, when you get successful and you get integrated to the society, you would start becoming a little bit more honorable and nice. And you try to value that success. He did none of that. He was just...
just the same guy
he was before... he became successful, just that he had now more money to spend on wine and women. Yeah. Right? So
better wine, better women.
And you would wonder why he did that. And you know, this guy had such profound understanding of himself that he made his declaration to the world on his tombstone on why he chose to be the same person before and after success. You can find it in the two words he inscribed on his tombstone, which said, "Don't try." He just summarized everything that he had to tell to the world in just two simple words.
Don't try.
Don't try. Right? So.
At least he remained true to himself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And, and I have not heard something more profound, which goes back at the base of looking at humans as you know, yet another form of the animal species, right? So for just those two words, you know, he's my all-time favorite.
Wow.
It just summarizes how I feel about life.
Yeah, right? Brilliant. Abby, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We know you're an incredibly busy guy, so we appreciate the time you've made available to us. It's been good fun. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Abby. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.